Welcome to the iCoder podcast with Ian McDuff.
Hello once again, podcast and ODR audience, and welcome to another in the sequence of the iCoder podcast series. I'm Ian McDuff, and I'm your host for this series, and speaking with you from Wellington in Aotearoa, New Zealand. In this conversation, I'm delighted to be joined by our colleague in the ODR and Digital Justice Network, Dr. Fahima Abedi. Welcome. Good to see you. Well, I can see you, but of course the podcast people won't. Fahima is research fellow at the Centre for AI and Digital Ethics at the University of Melbourne. And for about the past 10 years, decade, her work has explored the intersection of law and artificial intelligence. Fahima holds a PhD from Victoria University in Melbourne and an LLM from the National University of Malaysia, and is originally from Isfahan in Iran. So we're covering a good part of the world here. Currently, Fahima is engaged in the Ninian Stephen Law Program on New Legal Thinking for Emerging Technologies. It's a project that focuses on addressing the complex legal and ethical challenges posed by emerging technologies, specifically for lawyers in Australia, but as we'll see more widely. She is currently chief investigator in the development of a resilient legal advice for cyber and critical technologies in Vietnam as part of a project with the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade in Australia, DFAT, and also chief investigator for a research project entitled Measuring and Evaluating Sustainability, Gender Equality to Empower Victorian Indigenous Women's Ownership of Agricultural Land. If we have time, I'd love to get onto that. Fahima has published widely in some serious journals and presented work at international conferences, primarily on ODR, and she's made a significant contribution through her PhD research on ODR on developing standards for fairness, trust, and security in ODR generally. So welcome, Fahima. Thank you for taking time to join us in this podcast series. Good to have you here.
Thanks, Ian. Yeah. Introduction and inviting me. I'm delighted to be here. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, let's see where we take this. There's several elements of your research work that I think our audience are bound to be interested in. And of course, in a way, start with the basics. So what you've been working on is issues of trust and security and procedural fairness in ODR. I guess two aspects that what got you into this and where did your research take you and are there particular challenges?
So when I was doing my PhD with Professor John Zalesniku, who I'm sure you know him, he's a very well-known expert in ODR. So we came up with this idea how we can develop standards for three concepts of fairness, security, and trust in online dispute resolution systems. At that time, when I was working, there weren't much principles around the ODR systems. And then we adopted a mixed method research, which is like qualitative and quantitative. And we came up with how we should measure these principles. So with the procedural fairness, I came up with that we need to have six different elements, such as equal treatment, respect, neutrality, trustworthiness, consistency, and ethicality rule to measure procedural fairness. Procedural fairness, as we know, is very important. It's about the views of the, it's more about the people's views about the treatment they have received during the resolution process. And then we looked into the concept of trust and how we can measure trust. And then we came up that we need to have three main elements to measure trust, such as knowledge, expectation of fairness, and code of ethics. And regarding to security, we need three elements such as information security, privacy, and authentication. So how we develop these kind of principles. So I remember it was in 2015 when I traveled to US. There was an ODR conference at that time, mm-hmm. and I interviewed these ODR providers to understand how they are actually implementing these principles within their system. and how we can enhance this quality of access to justice for everyone. Because if we are saying that the ODR is going to provide access to justice, so we have to make sure that it's aligned with these principles. And then after I interviewed these ODR providers, I also conducted some surveys with the users of these ODR systems to find out how they feel about these principles. So that's how I came up with these principles. But if you want, I can explain these principles more.
When you were mentioning the procedural fairness, it just reminded me very much also of the early work in ADR before anyone had heard of doing this digitally. And to no one's great surprise, it turned out that on the research that provided people felt that they had been treated fairly, provided that they had had a hearing, even if they lost, and it wasn't necessarily mediation, might have been some other kind of thing, provided that there was a sense of being treated decently, they were happy with the outcome, even if they lost. And in a way, we're dealing with the same issues in the online world, aren't we?
Yeah, exactly. Because when we are talking about ODR, because it's online communication, yeah, it's very different from when we have offline communication, because you can see who is the mediator, who are the arbitrators. So usually when it comes into the online, it's more difficult to even trust the process. And if the parties feel that the process is fair, so they can also trust the neutrals and arbitrators and decision makers, and they can accept the outcomes of this decision. So, for example, one of the elements which I find out in my research was equal treatment. So if you want to bring this, if you want to say that the process of ODR is being fair, we need to make sure that both parties are being treated equally. And how we can provide that, for example, we should provide equal opportunity for both disputant parties to be heard and present their case. For example, they need to have the same language, or if not, we need to provide them with a translator. We need to minimize the imbalance power, because we know that they might have a different technological skills, or they might have a different internet skills. So that's another thing that we can create this equal treatment. Another thing was the respect. For example, we need ODR, the individuals need to receive that respectful behavior from decision makers and neutrals in ODR system. And this will increase their satisfaction with the ODR process. So for example, we can provide an opportunity for them to have more control over the process. For example, they can propose solutions, which we have this in ODR. And for example, we can have dignity and equitable treatment of disputant parties, regardless of the value of the purchase or the social status of the parties. Also, the proceeding cannot be delayed without any reasonable cause. So this was the elements which will help us to bring and measure respect regarding the procedural fairness in ODR process.
Okay. I have a couple of questions out of this, because this is very rich stuff. On the trust question, you probably more than anybody who's listening to this will be keeping up with current concerns about artificial intelligence and ChatGPT-4 and, not knowing who you're dealing with some of the time. Now, as I have the good fortune, which our listeners don't, of seeing you on screen, at the moment I'm reasonably confident that it is in fact you that I'm seeing, but you've already told me that the background that I'm looking at is not real. Yeah. And so going online creates elements of challenges to knowledge and trust. One of the issues that's been raised by other colleagues is not being sure or needing to be confident in mediation that there's no one else in the room, so that the information is not getting to people it shouldn't do. Are there particular challenges to creating trust caused by our use of artificial intelligence?
That's a
nasty question.
That's a very good question, Ian. So do you mean like by using artificial intelligence, or are you just like more about ODR?
Well, it's a bit of both, really, because I mean, AI is creeping in, like it or not. One of my colleagues, or one of our colleagues, wrote recently on LinkedIn how he'd used ChatGPT to write the mediation agreement, with the agreement of the parties, and it was edited by the parties' representatives. So AI is bound to be an increasing presence in ODR, and I just wonder. I mean, this is just thinking out loud. Just wonder what particular problems might be created for trust, which is a very human requirement. You know, I need to be able to trust the people I have in front of me. If what Ethan Katch has referred to as the fourth party, if there's a fourth party in the room, and that fourth party is not just the digital technology, the digital intermediation, but is artificial intelligence, are there challenges that we're not quite sure of yet with digital technology and challenges to trust? There's a very wide question, I know.
Definitely there are some challenges we still don't know. But I can say, like, one of the things that we can, as this is very obvious, like transparency sure. of the process can just bring that kind of trust for the users. So if we can give like a description about the process to the users of, for example, the ODR system, or if we are going to say, okay, we are going to use AI, but in which way the AI is going to support us during this dispute resolution. Okay. So that can bring more trust. So the knowledge, which I was talking in the beginning, how we can give this kind of knowledge. For example, if the disputants can have some kind of information about the, not just only about the process, also about the neutrals who are going to help them with the dispute resolutions. For example, we can give some kind of bio of these mediators or the arbitrators, and they can be, they can just like, we can create that kind of trust for them that these are the mediators that they can help you with the process. And another thing is just like the consistency. So if we can make sure that the process is consistent, and they're going to receive a consistent outcomes, that will also create more trust. Okay. Regarding to that question about the challenges of how we can trust, so that's a very, I can say that's a very, I'm not sure like about what can be other challenges. But we did a research at Lathrop University with some of my colleagues. And at that time, we were looking into the effects of using online communication tools on dispute resolution practitioners after COVID. So for example, the mediators who use, for example, Zoom. And it was interesting because there were a lot of different issues arising from using, for example, Zoom, specifically regarding family law disputes. And the reason was because at that time, for example, in Victoria was lockdown. And then for the family disputes, the disputant parties, the couple were not feeling comfortable because the children were at home at the same time. So that was one of the issues, but it's not specifically related to the concept of trust. But yeah, the trust is always very complicated when it comes into online, because how we can trust and how we can show that the other party who is claiming to be is that person. Yeah. And that brings the concept of the security and authentication. Mm-hmm. And, for example, in my PhD, I said, yeah, we have to make sure that we need to make sure that the parties in online transaction or communication are who they claim to be And then that's why we need to have authentication of ODR system. And this can be brought into the system by, for example, having some identity actions to authenticate the user of the device. Or we can have some platform administrator implemented into the ODR system.
Yeah, and that's very helpful because it really reinforces what you've said, reinforces one of the points you raised at the outset, which is each of those criteria you've developed, they're interlocked, they're necessarily related, and particularly in order to resolve the issues of trust, you also need issues of authentication and transparency. And transparency seems particularly important. So it's a pattern that you're looking to create, and you can't cherry pick it. You can't simply say, well, you know, trust me because I am who I am, say I am, but you have to have systems in place, say this is how you know what's authentic, this transparency, authentication, and systems put in place. That's very helpful. I think I'm going to have to come back and think more about that because the trust one is so important. The second question I had from your opening comments relates to equality and fairness, and you referred in passing to the fact that we have to ensure that there's equality between parties who don't necessarily have the same level of access to or competence in digital technologies. Had you given some thought about how, say, a mediator working online manages that issue if somebody is working on a slow network, or even if their network is equal to others, they're just not that good at it? They might be older or younger, or they have language issues, they have cultural differences. How do we work towards managing and implementing that equality? Because it's one thing to deal with the human level of equality and inequality, but when we're now adding a layer of digital intermediation, which requires us to take particular notes, doesn't it?
Yeah. So that's why the mediators and are, first of all, they need to first go through these trainings and see like how they should, because the online dispute resolution is, I can't say totally different, but it needs its own kind of a skill. So the online arbitrators and mediators need to have this kind of specific trainings that how they should bring this equal treatment for disputants. And they have to consider these kind of issues and how they can support both parties in this regard. So for example, like if they have a problem with the language, they need to make sure that before the, for example, the mediation session, that they have a translator, or make sure that they have a proper internet access, or so that's the thing that the mediators and the arbitrators should think beforehand of this dispute resolution settlement, or even if you are using a ODR platform.
In a way, the treating people equally requires, in some cases, treating them unequally, because you know, a mediator may need to provide extra assistance for somebody who doesn't have the technical competence or the same level of technical skill. Because it's another layer of potential barrier, isn't it? I mean, and that's not to discount the enormous advantages that the technology has given us. So I think what your research you're telling us about has highlighted is both the significant potential and promise, and also the things that now we need to pay attention to. And I suspect, you know, certainly during lockdown, a lot of the mediators that I'm aware of who initially said, oh, no, you can't do this stuff online, it has to always be done face-to-face, suddenly discovered that they were experts in online dispute resolution, but simply migrated their practice over to the online, such as this, onto an online platform, such as Zoom, without necessarily taking account of the kinds of core issues that you've raised here, and these go to the practice of, you know, ethical mediation, don't they?
Yeah, exactly. And one of the things like I looked into that was the code of the ethics that we need to have for the neutrals, and so that that can be also included in that code of the ethics, and they can also have some kind of like certificate that how they need to be make sure that the both parties are being behaved equally online and provide that kind of equal treatment.
This is rich stuff, and I just know that there will certainly be some in the audience who will want to follow up on this. Can I move on to one of the other topics you're dealing with, the Nini and Stevens project, looking at the what you've referred to as the complex legal and ethical challenges posed by emerging technologies for lawyers. Taking us outside the ODR field, I think this does, but what is it you're looking at here? What's your research brief?
So new legal thinking for emerging technologies is a four-year project which is powered by the Menzies Foundation, and it's under the Nini and Steven Law Program. So in this project, new legal thinking is mainly describing the kind of the skills that lawyers need to go beyond the analysis of law based on existing precedent and legislation. So we are aiming to understand what kind of legal and ethical or even technical challenges that lawyers are facing when they want to give advice in regarding to new emerging technologies. To find out this, we have to better understand these challenges. Center for AI and Digital Ethics, CADE. So we are running a number of emerging tech and law leader forums and seminars to address these challenges and see what are the actual issues that the lawyers are facing. And also I did interviews with 26 in-house lawyers as a part of this project to have a better understanding and more in-depth about these issues. And now based on those findings, that we are developing some surveys and we want to ask a broader number of lawyers and see like whether they also have those kind of issues with emerging technology. We realized that in this project that usually the lawyers get involved in the later stage of adopting emerging technology, usually in the contract stage. But what about the design stage? Whether the lawyers need to be involved, for example, when they're in an organization, in-house lawyers, whether they need to be engaged in the early stage of adopting emerging technology, such as a design stage or ideation. The lawyers, they will see themselves as a service provider who are identifying the risk rather than providing value to the emerging of technology.
Okay. So this is not just a question of lawyers who are using technologies such as technology that we're using now, but who are advising on others using those technologies. Can you give one or two examples of what kind of technologies you have in mind?
So we are talking about the emerging technology. For example, it can be AI and machine learning and Internet of Things. So any of these. But if I want to give you an example, just imagine, for example, we have a bank, for example, as an organization. Yes. And they have their customer data, and then they are want to develop a kind of a software, for example, for customizing the loan services to the customers. How much of data they can use from these customers they have, and how much control they can have over these data. And when they seek the advice from the lawyers, how familiar are the lawyers with this kind of issues that might arise in the future about the using of, for example, customers' data, and how they can help in regarding to designing, for example, this software, how the IT team, IT people and the technical team in this organization will value the lawyer's opinion in this regard. So these are the kind of
Does this, I mean, it's a broader question, I think, but does this suggest to you, well, two questions. One, what are law firms going to look like in 10 years' time when they, my guess is that they won't just be lawyers, there will be people who have more technical expertise. And secondly, what is happening in legal education? Because lawyers, lawyers of my generation, whose most complex technology was moving to an electric typewriter, and now lawyers coming through need to have the kind of, if not expertise, then awareness of the gaps in their expertise. Because lawyers aren't necessarily familiar with having gaps in their expertise because they know everything. But this is a significant challenge that you're raising. And parenthetically, just a little while ago, I started reading a book on blockchain and it just made my head boil because it's beyond me. But it's the sort of thing, if a bank clients are using blockchain and what you're using is smart contracts, then you need to know this stuff, don't you?
Sure, exactly. And the thing is just like with the emerging technology, the law is, we know that the law is not that fast, yeah? And we don't have that much legislation and the laws around the emerging technology. And the issues which are arising are new challenges every day. We are facing something new is coming up. So how we can upskill the lawyers with these new challenges of emerging technology? And so one of the aims of our project at the end is just like how we can develop a cross-disciplinary subject that the students, not just only the law student, but also the students from the IT, because they also need to know about the law as well. Yeah, they are
absolutely
the systems, and they can work together. And how we can provide the law students with more, I can say more skills, or I can, if I want to rephrase the word, like to be how we can help the law students to understand the technology which they are going to work with in the future.
This is stepping aside just a little bit, but would you see this as now an essential, if even possibly a mandatory part of legal education that students are exposed to, more than just exposed to, become more familiar with the technology, because it's going to be unavoidable in practice and in future?
Yeah, definitely, because now I think like after COVID, we know that like we started using the technology much more than before. Sure. And without being like really prepared how to use the technology. And now we have now ChatGPT, like ChatGPT 3 compared to 4, like ChatGPT 3 was 1 out of 10 and now 4 is just like 9 out of 10. Yeah. So we can see like how fast this technology is just like growing and is affecting our lives. And I think yeah, definitely that the lawyers need to, the law students, the law schools need to have this kind of subject, which is more focused on technology and different aspects of technology and emerging technology. Yeah.
At the other end of the scale, with the law firms that you've dealt with, have you encountered any pushback, any resistance from practitioners? My guess, maybe older practitioners who haven't grown up with this stuff?
Not really. Just like a few responses I received from my interviews, they were saying like, we don't need to know a lot about the technology because that's something that the IT people and technologies should know. But I think we need to have some kind of understanding about technology if you're going to give advice about that. Yeah. And especially nowadays, which the technology is affecting every aspect of our lives, from health to all of different aspects, from finance, everything. We can't say that the law is something aside and it's not being affected from technology.
Yeah. As a sort of personal aside, what do you have a background in technology yourself, or how did you get into this?
I don't have the background in technology.
Yeah.
But I do a lot of self-studies with technology. Yeah. But I wish when I was doing my Master of Law, I had this opportunity to do a subject which is more, I'm at that time, like 2009, It was just like a little bit like far to predict that technology is going to be growing and
change so much in that time. But it does suggest that, you know, for those like you and like most of the people that I know in the business, we've arrived at technology kind of ill-formed but interested. And then obviously some come from more IT and computing background. I suppose some come from a tech background into law. So it's that interface where two different bodies of knowledge meet and have to find ways of talking sensibly to each other.
Yeah, exactly.
Interesting. Which takes me to the other project that you've been involved in more recently, with the project taking the question of providing resilient legal advice for cyber and critical technologies in Vietnam. I know this is very fresh because you're only just back from there, but and this is through the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade in Australia. What's, as much as you are able, what was the project? Who's your audience?
So the Building Resilient Legal Advice for Cyber and Critical Technologies, this is a 2-year project which is funded by DFAT and Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade of Australia. And this is, the project sits with a larger body of the new legal thinking for emerging technologies. Right. And at CADE, we got this fund to do this research and look into the challenges that the lawyers are facing. Vietnamese lawyers are our population in this project. What kind of legal and ethical challenges that in a different region of the world the lawyers are facing, and trying to learn not just only to see like what challenges they are facing with emerging technology, but also try to learn and see how they are dealing with these issues. And I think that's a very that's very important because we are doing the project in Australia, and we are doing exactly the same kind of concept, looking into Vietnam and how the lawyers are interacting with that. So we can just like do kind of comparison between two different regions and learn from each other, and try to find out a solution for these challenges, and see that it doesn't matter you're a lawyer in Vietnam, in Australia, or any part of the world. You might have same kind of challenges and issues with emerging technology, giving advice. Yeah.
And because you're fairly freshly back from Vietnam, what, 2-3 weeks ago, what stood out for you as being the questions that the people you met in Vietnam were interested to address? And I presume some of them were the same as you face in Australia, but were there other questions that were surprising to you or new?
So I haven't started analyzing the findings.
Sure. Yes, it's too soon.
I did interviews with 10 lawyers who are working in private law firms in Vietnam. And thanks to Ministry of Justice of Vietnam, who provided us with these lawyers and introduced us these lawyers. Interestingly, that the lawyers in Vietnam also have a very good knowledge of emerging technology, and they have a very good understanding about what is emerging technology, and they have worked with these kind of things. I didn't face any kind of specific question when I did my interviews. Yeah.
I guess what you suggest, even before we went on air to record this, you were suggesting that there is a kind of global familiarity. There's a kind of global network of problems that in a way gives a lie to the kind of national separation we all have, because of the very nature of our networks, we are connected that way. So it's, in some ways, it's not that surprising that the approach in Vietnam is familiar to you in Australia, or possibly from Iran or Malaysia or here in New Zealand.
So one of the questions which I do ask in my interviews from lawyers is that when you are facing an issue, because we don't have a relevant, so there might be not a relevant legislation or cases which you can refer when you want to give advice, what would you do? So, and the answer which I got from lawyers, whether they are Vietnamese or Australian lawyers, was that they will Google it, or they will try to connect with someone who is in United States or in Europe. And that's very interesting. So as I said earlier, like, the internet has made this global village, and yep. Very new concept, it's a kind of old concept, but we can see this is actually happening in this real world, and the lawyers from all different parts of the world are exchanging their ideas when they are facing similar issues. And because technology and emerging technology is cross-border, so the issues arising from that is also cross-border and can be same from the lawyers in different parts of the world.
There's a kind of yes but in my head here. It's not a challenge to that idea, because I think you're absolutely right. And I've certainly found that with my students in Singapore, is that if you didn't know something, it didn't matter. You didn't need to know. You could just Google it. And we all do that. But what you're also suggesting is that the technology has created this kind of global network of connectivity, which allows you and me to have this conversation, and allows this conversation to go up on LinkedIn and podcasts. But there's a potential point of tension where this kind of boundary-free technology meets the very bounded forms of national legal systems, because there are differences in style and principle and values between the legal systems of the United States or Canada or France or Portugal or Zambia or wherever it might be. And so there's still going to be those national differences. And do you see some of those differences at the legal system level being flattened by the technology? That's a nasty question.
So when I'm talking about the issues, I mean like the issues which are not being foreseen before, like unpredictable issues which is arising. And because there's a gap in the legislation, so that's why that the lawyers tend to try to seek advice from external lawyers who are, for example, overseas. With the national boundaries, you're right. And that's why, for example, if a lawyer is in Australia, they tend to more speak with the lawyers who are in US, because they kind of having this the state law and still the Commonwealth system that they have. But still, I can say that in some way they can support each other, the lawyers who are in different, even if they are in different legal systems, because the issues arising from emerging technology is unique, and is not it's more about how you can provide this support to your clients.
Okay. In a way, the technology issues are they're not independent of the legal system, but they kind of almost superintend. I mean, they're not tied necessarily to the value systems of the legal system. So the value system of the Malaysian legal system or the Chinese legal system, those are differences which will remain. But the technological questions you're suggesting are ones which are likely to be universal.
Yeah.
And so which enables you, you from Iran by way of Malaysia and into Australia to be able to talk to people in Vietnam about issues of technology, because those are shared issues, even if you're dealing with four very different legal systems and very different value systems. So we talk technology rather than, we're not actually talking jurisprudence, are we?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, because the jurisprudence that we kind of grew up with is linked to the kind of value system, the fundamental values of a legal system. So you might talk, we did years ago of Soviet legal systems or differences between civil law and common law. But that's, you're operating at a different level. I think this is what makes this particularly interesting, is that it's not independent of the legal system, but it suggests that there's this thin atmosphere floating above legal systems, which we all share, which enables us to say, we've got common issues here. You working in Brazil or Iran or wherever you might be, have similar issues raised by the technology, which are not the same as the actual foundational legal issues, are they?
Yeah, exactly. I can say, like, for example, for the cases such as criminal cases or family law disputes, they are really tied into our own legislations. Sure. But when it comes into the technology, because the nature of technology is cross-border. So I think the issues which are arising, it can be just cross-border as well.
Yeah. I mean, this gives me a different picture from, I've done about, 22 of these podcasts, and there's always something new, and it's just the image you've provided me, and I hope our listeners, is an intriguing one, because the differences between legal systems will remain, and so those who study comparative law and comparative legal systems will still continue the narrative about the differences between those legal systems. But the technology has a different uniting function.
Exactly.
And goodness knows what that's going to do to either flatten or exacerbate the differences. I mean, I'm not necessarily sure that we will go along with what Tom Friedman was writing about years ago about the earth being flat, because he suspected that all the technology would flatten out all the differences between Mumbai and Madagascar. But what you're suggesting is there's a connecting veil of some kind that technology provides, and at the same time provides a whole array of new challenges. Thank you for that. That's intriguing. That gives me a whole lot more to think about. Yeah. Is there more that you can or want to say about the Vietnam project, or should I come back to you in 6 months' time?
Yeah, because it's just like in the early stage, and we did the three days of workshop, me with Professor Ginny Patterson, who's a co-director of Center for AI Digital Ethics with Professor Tim Miller. We did a two-day workshop, which was about law and regulation, demystifying AI and cybersecurity. And we had like 70 participants over 3 days.
Wow.
From 13 different departments in Vietnam. And it was a very fascinating workshops we had over there. And we got a really good feedback from these
Wonderful.
Lawyers.
So this research project, you're going to do your data analysis, and then this will be written up, and hopefully you'll be able to tell people out in the ODR and digital world when that information is available, because I think there'll be a wide audience for it, and presumably it will go public in as much as academic work does go public. I've probably taken as much of your time as I should be allowed to take, and we should wind down this, but this is, for me at least, I mean, this has been fascinating, and I really do appreciate your sharing the work you've been doing, and ranging from the commentary on ethical issues and the challenges of working in the interface of the interface of those cultures of technology and law, and your recent work in Vietnam. So thank you so much for taking the time. I do appreciate that.
Thank you very much, Ian.
This podcast has been brought to you by ICODER, the International Council for Online Dispute Resolution. To learn more about ICODER or to become a supporting member, please visit our website at icodr.org.